Over time, MS-13 has become a national object of fear and political cudgel for both political parties as the equivalent of ISIS or Al-Qaeda and the primary criminal target of ICE. With over 10,000 members in dozens of states and thousands of grisly murders each year, author Stephen Dudley, in his new book MS-13, The Making of America's Most Notorious Gang, explores the malicious web of MS-13, but also enlightens us on how the gang is misinterpreted. Dudley brings us inside the dangerous group to tell a larger story of flawed U.S. and Central American policy and the exploitive and unequal economic systems they foster. Ultimately, MS-13 is the story of the modern immigrant and the perennial battle to escape a vortex of poverty and crime. Stephen Dudley is the co-founder of Insight Crime, a think tank devoted to organized crime and corruption in the Americas. As a journalist in Latin America, he spent most of the past two decades writing for The Washington Post, as well as reporting for NPR and the BBC. The new book is MS-13, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Stephen Dudley to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Joe, for having me.
Knowing that you have written, you've been a journalist for a long time in Latin America, you've written for The Washington Post and for NPR and BBC, reported for them as well. How did this become your beat?
Well, I with a partner who's also a journalist, about a decade ago, he and I floated out of journalism and created a think tank. That think tank is called Insight Crime, and all we do is cover organized crime in the Americas. We found ourselves sort of splitting up the region geographically. I covered Central America then, in Mexico mostly. Those were, you know, the kind of hot spots when we started out, still are to a large extent. And then he covered a lot of the sort of Andes region, kind of split up other things. You know, I don't want it to sound like we're sort of, you know, masters of the universe, but in essence, we had to set it up that way. And I found myself covering the gangs. You know, the reality of Central America is that gangs are super prevalent. They are super prevalent in the everyday lives of people in those countries and, you know, interrupt all the way to the highest levels of government, you know, activities. They can certainly dominate an entire budget, for example, you know, a security budget. So, you know, this is a major issue as it relates to organized crime. And I found myself looking at it. Now, over the years, what has happened is I've just gotten to know more about the issue itself, but also met more and more members of the gangs themselves. So I began to understand a lot more about, you know, what fuels the gangs, what motivates the gangs, what kind of makes a gang a gang. And really, you know, was inspired to try and separate what we think of as gangs versus what we think of as kind of larger organized crime. Gangs are not organized crime. And that was a major impetus of the book, but it came from looking at the gangs over a 10-year period.
So let's talk about how this particular gang came to be. And as you report, this basically started as a somewhat harmless social network.
Well, yeah, I mean, these frequently do start out as these relatively harmless social networks. In this case, they were kids, you know, young kids who found themselves in Los Angeles in the 1980s, early 1980s, late 1970s, early 1980s, and you know, found themselves displaced. Many of their families had fled a brutal civil war, in which they found themselves caught between the warring forces, the guerrillas on one side and a brutally repressive government on the other side that was supported by the United States, of course, and huge numbers of refugees, you know, literally, you know, hundreds of thousands of people were making their way to the United States, a lot of them, you know, in these very dense neighborhoods in Los Angeles and finding themselves, you know, surrounded by gangs. This particular one, the MS-13, was initially anyway very inspired by rock and roll music, heavy metal, to be more exact. So, you know, AC/DC, Iron Maiden, you know, those kind of bans. And, you know, imagine these young kids, you know, long hair and torn jeans and, you know, banging their head to the music. Yeah, that was what originally inspired them. And they had their first click name, you know, the sort of, you know, the way that they organize themselves is by clicks. And their first click name was Stoners. You know, it was this idea of rock and roll music. Now, of course, in that environment, that very, you know, violent environment, they found themselves under siege. And they developed a much more predatory and aggressive and extremely violent edge with time.
What ultimately gives it the edge? I mean, this does become about power and in some cases money, right?
You know, I think that there is an element of power and money, but that for me is very much in line with what we think of when we think about organized crime. International drug trafficking organization. You know,
yes.
they're very much along the lines of, you know, their goal is money and power. You know, and certainly those are related. In the case of the gangs, what I have found over the years of looking at them and speaking to them and dealing with them and dealing with law enforcement and community organizations and all the different elements and array of people that deal with them is that they're much more a kind of collective, a sort of social collective that is in much more about creating that community and sustaining that particular community. They're a rudimentary, at best, criminal organization, really hand-to-mouth operations dependent on things such as extortion, you know, small-level extortion in their areas of influence, because gangs mostly develop their criminal economies in their space where they operate, their geographic space, physical space in which they operate. So they're not exactly these massive, geographically spread out, you know, over multiple countries, you know, criminal organizations. They just don't operate that way. And for me, proof of it is that they've been around for 40 years. They have a kind of natural layout and membership in six different countries, and yet they are not involved in transnational criminal operations. They never have been. And when they try, it's normally an individual member, and they fail. And they fail because there's resistance to that, because the reason that they exist is for this social part. I mean, so for me, this is an element that I think is very important, and that is that they're a social group first, and they're a rudimentary criminal group second.
So talk a little bit about how policing as well as foreign and economic policy help shape MS-13 in the sense that what it does to shape the gang and as well as then how our immigration policy helps spread it.
Well, the book runs along sort of two parallel tracks. One track is the development of the gang, and I tell that through individual members that I met with and spoke with on many, many occasions. And that has its own, you know, dynamism and certainly organic growth involved in that. But the response to the gangs themselves also fuels them in a way. There is a very concerted effort in the late 1980s, and rightfully so, you know, because there was a lot of violence around things such as, development and control of crack cocaine industry and other drug businesses and things of that sort. There was an incredible amount of violence in L.A. in the late 1980s, and so the response was in some ways justified, but it became the sort of model. The model that sort of vilified entire communities, and this will sound familiar for those people who follow, you know, the way that the Trump administration has vilified entire communities, because it really begins back in the 1980s in L.A. And so that sort of reaction, or maybe even overreaction or overwrought reaction, which was the effort to kind of jail our way out of this problem leads to a mass incarceration of a lot of these guys. And they find themselves in another environment. And in that new environment, they're interacting with different kinds of criminal organizations, most notably jail-based criminal organizations. And in the MS-13's case, it's a group called the Mexican Mafia, which is much more sophisticated and has an umbrella organization that is up to 50 gangs. So now all of a sudden they're part of another type of criminal organization. They're beginning to absorb, you know, the ways in which they operate. And then the U.S., you know, police and in this case now immigration authorities start to get more and more involved. What do we do about this? You know, a lot of them are a lot of these people are sort of under a temporary status or they don't have any sort of immigration status. And so when they start to get out of jail, they begin to deport them in greater and greater numbers back to Central America. Thousands of ex-convicts are deported back to places like El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. And that is that's the beginnings of, you know, the MS-13 and its main rival, the 18th Street, which was also born in the streets of L.A., in Central America. So in a very odd way, it kind of had gone by then full circle. You know, initially the refugees to L.A., creation of gangs, mass incarceration, then mass deportation, and then they're back down to, you know, Central America. And then obviously what we've had in the last few years is this sort of completion, full completion of that circle, because the gangs are a major impetus for people to migrate to the United States. You know, so this is the process that I describe in the book.
It's hard to have a conversation about this, at least especially during this time, this political time. So many assertions have been made by the president and the Trump administration about MS-13. What is the, I mean, it's hard to put a percentage on it, but give us a sense of how much of that has a connection to what is actually on the ground and what you see and what you report about in the book.
Well, I think we need to put the MS-13 in perspective. The MS-13 is, you know, compared to, let's just take its main rival, the 18th Street, the MS-13 has anywhere, according to the FBI, between 8,000 and 10,000 members in the United States. The FBI says that the 18th Street has 50,000 members in the United States. So, you know, that is obviously five times larger than the MS-13, but you don't ever hear about the 18th Street. They have become a very useful way to conflate, you know, crime with immigration. And so, you know, all of these different aspects of the gang have to be put in perspective. The size of the gang, the number of murders as it relates to, you know, overall murders. You know, it's a very small number, but they're done in this, you know, this horrific in very graphic way, often, you know, use of machetes and knives, and they're done in collectives, you know, numbers of them. They are literally passing around knives to kill people. And this is part of the gang ethos. So, you know, that is real. But the numbers of people that they're killing is rather small. And the people that they're targeting are not, you know, they're Latinos. I mean, they're the people living in their communities. They're kids the same age as they are, you know, teenagers or early 20s, you know, those. So, you know, I think we just have to put these things in perspective. It's not to minimize, you know, what the gang is and what it represents in certain respects, especially in those communities. But it is trying to put things in perspective. I guess the third thing I would mention is this whole idea of conflation of migrants. You know, there is no central authority within the gang that is moving around its members like chess pieces around the region. It just doesn't work like that. They move organically with other migrants, and they're in very, very small numbers. You know, the last numbers for which we have data on this, we're talking about, you know, 2017, where over 500,000 people were stopped crossing the border, and a couple of hundred were thought to be members of MS-13 or could have been members of MS-13, you know, and many of those in you know, could have been trying to flee the gang themselves. I chronicle, you know, a few stories in which the gang members themselves are fleeing the gang. This is very common. They're fleeing their own gang. So, you know, there's a lot of things that just need to be put into perspective.
What do you think the answer is as far as working with the members and trying to get this in control and ultimately what needs to be done?
Well, I think the first thing is that we need to think of this as, you know, it certainly is a law and order issue on one level, but it also is a social issue. We need to think about how we distribute our resources to the various pieces of the state and beyond that assist in integrating people, in giving young kids opportunities in helping out kids in schools, in helping to prop up, you know, non-governmental organizations and church organizations that work with wayward youth and, you know, on primary and secondary prevention schemes, which are attempting to get at youth before they enter the gangs. So there's a whole series of things that we've kind of forgotten about, you know, and completely defunded, really. And we need to turn our attention back to those, because those social and economic programs are the safety net for a lot of these kids that are caught in these very difficult circumstances. And if we don't catch them, then the gang does.
The name of the book is MS-13, The Making of America's Most Notorious Gang. Stephen Dudley, I thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Be well. Again, the name of the book is MS-13, The Making of America's Most Notorious Gang. It is published by Hanover Square Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.